Here's two questions from contemporary philosophers. The philosophers the last 30, 40 years have been asked to go find these sentences in various people's writings. One big question made particularly famous, at least in this form, elation, by Hilary Putnam, is the question, how does language hook onto the world? Hook is a kind of metaphor, but a less graphic metaphor might be something like, how does language connect with, or how can language be in touch with, how can language really make firm, stable contact? How do the words get a hold of the things such they don't lose them again? You say stuck to them. You want an even more graphic picture. It's a bunch of words. There's actually, when different people go on to ask this question, they might ask it slightly differently. One of the things they'll be worried about is whether those differences make a difference. So one kind of question would be, how do we know whether we mean this or that? Or how do we tell if we're talking about this or that? How do we tell if our words are hooking onto that thing? Or this kind of stuff or that kind of stuff? That's an epistemic question. How do we tell? How do we know whether it's a case of the word picking out this rather than that? I'm going to try to show you, before we're done today, that that's a Cartesian construal of this question, in the sense of Cartesian, we spent some time trying to elucidate in the previous lectures. Another way to understand the question would be something like, how is it that language could so much as have a bearing in the world? How could words so much as have meaning? How could there be something which is my taking myself to mean water when I say water? Regardless of whether I've got it right or not, but I take myself to be saying something such that there's rightness or wrongness involved. How could that word have a meaning such that the meaning I take it to have might, involve correct or incorrect use? That's a Kantian question. Here's another question, which we'll focus on today. Let's just put it this way without a how. We could turn this into a how question. Let's just put it this way because it's how it comes up in our reading for today. Do our cognitive processes reach the objects themselves? Or if you want to be a little more vivid with your metaphor, reach all the way to the objects themselves. If you take the cognitive power in question to be something like perception, you're concerned with perceptual knowledge, that can be a question you can ask within a Cartesian picture. How can my perceptual experience that I'm standing in front of a classroom of students reach all the way to the fact that there's a classroom full of students? Isn't it just a perceptual experience? I could be dreaming, it'd be exactly the same. So the fact itself transcends my cognitive powers of perception. It's always something more. It always falls short. It's always on this side of the veil of perception, or the Cartesian gap, in this case, a perceptual gap. That's one way to understand it. It's not the only way to understand the question. Maybe you can see what the other way is. If not, we'll get there. So here are two questions. These two questions themselves, this question itself, since cognitive powers can involve our cognitive powers for talking and thinking, as well as perceiving and knowing, this question can also take in to be a species of this question on either of its understandings. So what we're going to talk about is these questions and how unclarity about what we're asking here can get us into trouble. We're going to do this today by looking at the American philosopher Hilary Putnam. This is a slightly awkward exercise for me because Hilary Putnam was my PhD director. I have incredible respect for him. I really think, without hopefully being biased, that he is one of the great and important philosophers of the second half of the 20th century. One of his virtues, one thing I like about him a lot, which is somewhat unusual in Anglo-American philosophy, at least when I was growing up, less unusual now, is that he In the following respect, he's more like a continental philosopher, if you will. He works on a lot of different areas of philosophy, and he cares about having what the Germans call an Überblick in philosophy. So he wants to know different areas are connected. He has a sense that problems that are coming up in philosophy of quantum mechanics are not all that different in form from questions that are coming up in very different areas of philosophy, and brings his wisdom from one area to another, back and forth. I think that's all to the good. He's been a great exemplar for me there. But that also means when you do that, there's all sorts of possibilities of confusion. When you pick up roots and plunk down on another local debate, it sounds a little bit like that one. Are they the same debate or not? So that's one issue about Putnam, as he tries to connect things in the reading for today. Senses, sense, nonsense, and the senses. Is that what it's called? Sense, nonsense, and the senses, his Dewey lectures. Is he connecting the dots between these different issues that are coming up correctly? Also, it's perhaps worth saying something about Putnam autobiographically for a moment. Putnam has worked in a lot of different areas of philosophy. He's also famous for changing his mind a lot. So he's not a philosopher who's stayed stuck. There's a joke in a book called The Philosopher's Lexicon, which I think you can get online if any of you are interested. It's edited by Daniel Dennett, which consists of entries that are words that have meanings, but they're formed out of the last names of philosophers, mostly analytic philosophers. And one word is Hilary. A Hilary is a unit of time during which a famous philosopher holds a view, 6 weeks long. As in, I held that view two or three Hilaries ago. And according to Dennett's lexicon, that's the origin of the expression Hilary term at Oxford. Oxford has three terms, Trinity, Michaelmas, and Hilary. They're about 6 weeks long. The joke is they're named after Hilary Putnam, because that's how long he holds a view. That's an exaggeration. It also makes it sound like he changes his mind more than he does. What I'm more interested in is not exactly what view he holds, but what kinds of topics he's working on. That's the start I wanted to say something about for a moment. And there, too, there's been some shift. A paper he wrote in the mid-70s was very famous. It's called The Meaning of Meaning. That paper had to do with, it's one of the places this question came up, how and whether language looks onto the world. Putnam put forward a view that later became called semantic externalism. I don't think we need to worry about all the details here right now. But one thing I'll point out is that even there's a kind of instability about what the question is. The initial thought experiment in that paper, which Putnam made very famous, and it's a kind of thought experiment people run for lots of things now. It's the so-called twin Earth thought experiment. He ran it about, you can run this about lots of things. People now run them in personal identity, and for self-knowledge, and for all kinds of issues. It's a kind of thought experiment. Once you see you can run it in philosophy, you can start running them in other areas. Putnam's thought experiment went like this. Imagine we're on our planet, we're in a certain situation, we have something that looks just like water, and we drink it, and we talk about it, and we say, that's water. Now imagine people on another planet. That planet has slightly different physical and chemical properties from our planet. So on that planet, the thing that's running free, that's falling from the earth, that's coming out of springs, that you can drink, that's good for you, is not chemically identical to water. If you run to write down its chemical equation, it would not be H2O. It doesn't really matter what its chemical equation is. It could be H2O plus something, it could be a little different, it could be a lot different. Actually, it doesn't matter at this point. All that matters is it's not water in the sense in which water is H2O. Putnam just says, without specifying any further, it's XYZ. We don't need to know what its chemical formula is. We don't even know how much it's like water. It's not identical. And then the point is, I'm going to put this in a way that will make a certain connection explicit, but it's there already. From within, these two scenarios are not distinguishable. If I'm on Earth, or if I'm on twin Earth, and I say water, I can't tell if I'm in a situation in which I'm talking about H2O or XYZ. That is, I hope you see, I could spell this out further, but for those of you who know the article, I hope you see that this is a Cartesian format in the sense in which I've tried to bring out how those things work. We have here something which is a paradigm case, or best case, for a word whose meaning we know. You don't have to be an expert, or at least initially looks like you don't need to be an expert. That's in Putnam's initial attempt to solve this. Looks like maybe you do need experts, even to say what the meaning of water is. That's one premise that can be challenged, hence the thesis of linguistic distribution of labor. But in the initial setup, it looks like we have a pretty good case of a word we know how to use. And then we construct a scenario. We don't do it this time through dreaming, but we do it through a different kind of scenario, in which we can't tell whether we're in the usual situation or in that situation. We have no way from within in which we can tell. And then we can raise a doubt about, are we in such situations really referring to water or not? You can make a less humdrum case than twin Earth. I could pour you a glass of something that's chemically not, strictly speaking, water. It's got a little bit of something else into it. You know? In fact, you know, in America, the water in certain parts of the country has fluoride in it, which is very good for you. Don't worry. There are some people that worry that if we have fluoride in our water stream, the commies, since the Cold War has ended, they're not quite as worried about this. Now with Al-Qaeda, they're starting to get worried about putting anything in the water again. But the point is, they're not drinking pure H2O. They can't tell. You could have run the thought experiment without twin Earth. All twin Earth does is make it's very visible, as it were, the Cartesian structure of the thought experiment. Now, here then we have a worry. The reason it's called semantic externalism, Putnam's conclusion in this famous paper is, meanings ain't in the head, as he put it in his inimitable American. Is he starting to, there it looks like he's starting to challenge a certain Cartesian assumption about the structure of the gap. That is, the natural Cartesian assumption is, as in the case of perception, what it is to perceive a certain state of affairs, that's here. How things are, that's over there. Similar assumption with respect to meaning, whether I mean water or not, what my words mean, that's something like a function of something that's in my mind. And then how things are in the world, that swings free of what's in my mind. And what Putnam tried to bring out with that experiment is, if that were true, we'd never actually know. Put it in Cartesian terms for the moment. The paper's actually hovering, but I'll put it in Cartesian terms for the moment. We never actually know if our words mean what they do. Putnam's way of trying to crash that assumption is to actually break, I'm not saying he puts it this way, I'm saying you can see what he's doing, it's fitting in other cases, break with a fundamental Cartesian assumption about the gap and say that it's not true, that the realm of meaning is a self-standing realm. How it is completely constituted from the near side of the gap. And what things mean, whether they mean that or not successfully, that's on the far side of the gap, and we can't get there unless we have access to some divine sideways on point of view. Rather, he wants to suggest, no, what the words mean is itself a fact of the environment. That's his way of starting to try to break the Cartesian mold. So initially, in early Putnam, you have a question that clearly follows a Cartesian format and the way it gets you puzzled. And the initial question is, can you tell or not? But what happens, and it's starting to happen already in that article, what clearly happens in later Putnam's work, I'm just going to say this quickly, we'll have more occasion to talk about this next class. I'm just going to say this now, is it starts to turn into a Kantian question. So by the time you look at a book like Reason, Truth, and History, you read the opening chapters of Reason, Truth, and History, the question that Putnam's struggling with there is, how can our words refer? What's the difference between, he changes the example, but what's not? If we had a word that was water, and we had a word that was water star, example there is cat star, but let's not worry about that. That is another word whose extension was very similar but not identical to this. What would it mean for me to mean one thing rather than another? What would it be for there to be the determinate content to my referring one way rather than another? Now it's not, we know the difference between these two things, how can we tell? The question is turning to a question about what is reference such that there is something which is referring with our words. So as Putnam, and this becomes even more explicit if you look at later Putnam in the 80s and early 90s, so that this Cartesian question turns into a Kantian question. But in these essays, even here, you'll see a bit of an instability. It's a tendency to get the thing started in a Cartesian frame. Now, how it is that a Cartesian question could turn into a Kantian question? That's something I allowed myself to say. It's not something we've talked about at all in this class. So far, we've just said there's two kinds of problems. These Cartesian ones, these Kantian ones, there's some differences, there's some interesting similarities. We've just left it like that. We'll come back to that. But I just thought I'd mention, in Putnam's work, there's an increasing emphasis, as you go through the 80s and early 90s, on Kantian problems. And that's something I think even at the time that was happening in Putnam's work, not all of his readers really appreciated it. Maybe I'll give you one little reference. He has a collection, there's two collections of essays of his papers that are actually edited by me, I'm afraid. So I'm not just an observer here, I'm a participant in the crimes of philosophy. And the collection is called Words and Life, and it has an introduction. And if you look at pages, the introductory pages are in this funny Roman numbering, but if you look at pages 42 to 46, so that's just five pages, I try to give a description there of certain what was clearly a certain kind of Kantian problem about the possibility of language, thought, judgment having content that Putnam's extremely worried about in the essays that are collected in this book. This is now the early 90s, essays written in the late 80s, very beginning of the 90s. So you can see very clearly from some of the quotations I give and the material in Putnam I'm summarizing there that he's extremely worried at this point about Kantian questions, if you want evidence, there's some evidence. But now we want to talk about the Dewey lectures. And what happens to Putnam in the Dewey lectures. One other piece of background which will matter for our class, which is that one of the things that happens to Putnam starting from the middle of the 1980s on, the late 80s, is he starts reading a lot of John McDowell. He's very impressed with John McDowell. Slowly, takes a while. There's various resistances, but he reads one thing he likes, he reads another thing he likes. The first thing by McDowell he read that really gripped him, that he really liked, was McDowell's essay, Criteria to Feasibility and Knowledge, an essay we're going to talk about in this class. It's in your reader in a few meetings. One thing we're going to worry about is, when we get to it, I'm doing things in a funny order here, is what's the relationship between that essay and Mind and World? A more famous book that McDowell publishes, around, I guess he publishes in 94, is that right? But people like McDowell had already read it before that, lectures he gave at Oxford. What happens is that Putnam's reading of Criteria to Feasibility and Knowledge controls his reading of Mind and World. I think it's true actually for a lot of people who are reading make Tao in a certain way. They read that early essay of his. They think they understand what his problems are. They read other things, and they try to fit it into their understanding of that early essay. When we get to that early essay, we'll see that it's very much worried about problems of a Cartesian form. It's particularly raising questions about philosophy of perception. And it's trying to show something about what I've been calling the Cartesian structure of a certain kind of format. So the assumption is that mind and world has the same topic. And we have some of these words that we put on the board in the last couple of classes when we were looking at Price and Lewis and trying to see how we can get into trouble assimilating. Words like inside and outside, words like reach all the way to, or make contact with, or directly present, something directly presenting itself to consciousness, all those kinds of expressions. And we saw how they could shift from a Cartesian to a Kantian register. And in mind and world, you do have McDowell using this imagery. I think he's using it in a way which is much more continuous in mind and world with the way Lewis is using it, rather than the way Price was using it. The end of last class, we had some things on the board in connection with my lecture in Lewis, and I drew a circle and I called that the conceptual, and asked, what's outside that boundary of the conceptual? And we had Lewis worried about how the given must be conceived of as outside of the boundary of the conceptual. There are sentences in mind and world which say things like this. The conceptual, the sphere of the conceptual, is not bounded on the outside. It has no boundary. It is itself open to, another metaphor, not being bounded and open, or flip. It's metaphors that are flip sides of each other, to that which is given. Those metaphors are functioning in a Kantian register, as he's picking up on a problem exactly like Lewis's. Not because he's read Lewis at that point necessarily, but because they're both working off of a certain understanding of what Kant's problem is. But Putnam picks this up and understands it in a different way. So that's what we're going to try to look at a bit today. First, let's look at how the Dewey lectures start and see what Putnam's trying to argue. Putnam is trying to say in the Dewey lectures, there's an assumption that has run through philosophy for the last 300 years. And it's responsible for all the fundamental problems. This is, not an unambitious little piece of work. It's really responsible for all of the problems in perception and philosophy. Perception, philosophy of language, philosophy of truth. Those are three areas he talks about most. Theories of truth, the third lecture. So in philosophical reflection, language, perception, language, and truth. Those are the three cases discussed the most, but he's, I think, suggesting even further. Certainly references to philosophy of mind, philosophy of cognitive science. He's saying there's an assumption that's responsible for all of the trouble. And all of these people are making this assumption. That's why they're in trouble. If they'd stop making this assumption, they wouldn't be in trouble. That's the rhetoric of the book. And the question is that going to work as a criticism of all of the figures he wants to criticize? My question is not, is this a good criticism of some of the people he wants to criticize? Perhaps it is. I'm not doubting that. The question is whether it has the generality he thinks it has. What's the assumption? Putnam calls it the interface conception. This is the crucial assumption. They have assumed an interface. And then the question really becomes, if this is the crucial assumption that's messed up philosophers in all areas of philosophy, that naturally puts us in the position we want to know, well, what is the interface conception? Because we don't want to have it, because it's the thing that leads to all the trouble. And one of the things I want to say is that if you ask this question, it's very unclear what the interface conception is supposed to be. because I think it's trying to be more than one thing at once. I think to the extent that what the interface conception is supposed to be gets adumbrated in a way that's clear in Putnam's book. And this is mostly if you stick to the first lecture and a half. Then the interface conception is going to come into view as an assumption that there is what I call, in my previous classes, a Cartesian gap. There's a gap that has a Cartesian structure, and there has to be something between the two sides of the gap. But we'll try that out. But Putnam also wants the interface conception to speak to lots of contemporary work that's being done on this problem, this language hook onto the work. And there, insofar as one can speak of a gap or an interface at all, it's not clear to me it any longer has the same structure. So what is the interface conception? That's what we need to know. Second thing is, if you look at quotation, let's skip quotation one. I was going to say some things about Lewis to make for a better continuity between last class and this class, but having wasted so much time already, I think I'm going to skip that. Let's go to quotation two. You'll see he says, in McDowell's view, the key assumption responsible for the disaster is that the idea that there has to be an interface between our cognitive powers and the external world. So we've got various constraints on what the interface conception is supposed to be. One thing is it's supposed to be the assumption across all these different writings of these different people he's arguing with in contemporary philosophy. Another thing is it's an assumption that McDowell has identified. And it becomes clear if you read the Dewey lectures, he thinks, especially in Mind and World, that's the work of McDowell that he's working on, where McDowell has identified this assumption. So one question would be, is there something that's going to work the way Putnam thinks the interface conception works as an assumption that causes trouble, and something that is at the same time something that McDowell is identifying as the key assumption in Mind and World? Are those, as it were, co-satisfiable constraints on an interpretation of what the interface conception is? We won't really be able to answer that question until we look at McDowell, but I want to plant the question now. What's the crucial assumption? Well, here's how he glosses it. The crucial assumption is that there's an interface between our cognitive powers and the external world. To get that clear, he restates it. The idea that our cognitive powers cannot reach all the way to the objects themselves. So the crucial assumption is that this is a good question, and if the answer to this question is no, our cognitive powers on their own steam, off their own bat, by themselves, cannot reach all the way to the objects themselves. That's what the interface conception is. But then the question becomes, well, what does this mean? What does it mean to claim that the objects cannot reach all the way to themselves? What kind of philosophical assumption is there? And I think part of what happens in the Dewey lectures, if we had more time, I'd do this more slowly, but since we only have a class for Putnam and then we have to move on, I'm proceeding somewhat dogmatically. But you should read the Putnam and satisfy yourself as to the merits or lack there of what I'm saying. I think what you'll find is Putnam's construal of this issue has to waffle between a Cartesian and a Kantian construal of what the issue is in order for it to both make contact with his initial construal and the kind of use he wants to put various people like John Austin and the kind of connection he wants to make to McDowell's work in contemporary philosophy of language and his own work in contemporary philosophy of language at the same time. So, anyhow, let's not worry too much more about what this means right now. He just says, okay, boom, that's the interface conception. You answer that question with a no. And he says, if we could overcome this assumption, then we could embrace with a sound philosophical conscience the natural realism of the common man. So here's another one of these phrases, the natural realism. The natural realism of the common man. That's a quotation, as it happens,
from William James.
William James, in his, some of his work, Philosophy of Perception, was railing against what he called idealism. That was a bad view. But his colleague, Josiah Royce, held that he got it from people like Hegel. It's a feature of somebody like William James, and he thought Berkeley's view wasn't all that different. Something that Royce would have contested. Those were all idealists. Bad view. It cuts us off from the objects, he thought. What we want, William James said, is to return to the natural realism of the common man. That's a phrase James could use. I don't think it's a way of speaking you'd find in John Austin, but somebody who's speaking in the name of Austin, as Putnam claims to be, might also use this phrase. Someone speaking in the name of Wittgenstein, as Putnam, I think, also takes himself to be doing here, might also use this phrase. As a gloss on something McDowell's doing in, say, Mind and Will, you could use this phrase. I don't think any of those philosophers, as far as I can see, would have any particular need to disown the phrase. The question is, what does it mean? If it's the twin of this, if you think, well, there's this philosophical picture that doesn't let us get all the way to the objects themselves, but the natural realism of the common man is one. Before we had a certain philosophical problem, we thought our cognitive powers could. Then all of the ambiguity of what this means is built into this in an even more compressed way. You know, what's the opposite of realism here? So this too is subject to the same waffle. So this is putting it in terms of a negative way, in terms of the, as it were, espousal and rejection of a skeptical position. This is a certain slogan that wants to deny that in the name of a certain kind of phenomenological naivete, or second naivete, return to naivete, Putnam will speak in philosophy. But all of the ambiguities that are swept under the rug here are still swept under the rug here. It's still a question about whether people who use these phrases are all talking about the same thing. I'm not doubting it might, you know, in its vagueness, be equally apt for each of them. I'm not trying to say something like, Wittgenstein is, but William James isn't really speaking for the natural. That's not the point here. The point is what the issue is. That there's a common, there's a joining of a common philosophical problematic of the same shape can't be deduced from the fact that within philosophy of perception, this banner is one that you can raise up over what a certain philosopher is doing. Now, I say that even though, and there might be a lot that's true of these different philosophers, James, Austin, Putnam, so forth. I mean, the kind of thing Putnam says in the Dewey Lectures and would want to say and says elsewhere is, look, you don't understand me if you think natural realism here is a label for a philosophical position. When I defend this, I'm not defending a philosophical position. I'm trying to explode a certain philosophical confusion. Once the philosophical confusion is exploded, we can go back to saying what we previously were able to say before we were confused. So it's not meant to be a label for a position, something more familiar, a kind of way that Putnam talks at a different point, echoing another kind of philosophers to say something like, this is an attempt to explicate and rescue something like our pre-philosophical understanding of certain matters. Our understanding of our, if you will, cognitive powers, or our cognitive relation to the world prior to its corruption by a certain kind of philosophy. And then there might be a view about what's corrupted us, whether it's the scientific revolution or something bigger than that or something. You know, Rorty thinks it's, you know, ultimately certain theological assumptions. Somebody else might think it's something much more local that happened in 20th century philosophy. But the point is that all of that could be true across different uses of this slogan, and this slogan still is going to be just as unclear as a way of picking out what the philosophical issues are as this slogan is, because the one is still the denial of the other. You know, unless we're clear about what's, you know, what the shape of the philosophical issue is, We're not sure whether we're really talking about the same thing when two people say that. So what Putnam notices in McDowell is that McDowell is interested in an issue that looks like it can be summed up by arguing with somebody who wants to answer no to this question. But McDowell wants to deny that. So McDowell is saying something looks like you could sum up this way. Even though McDowell doesn't use quite this quotation from William James. McDowell does talk about common sense and certain things being truisms that philosophy has made it hard for us to grasp. And Putnam uses all of that as a sign that he and McDowell are saying the same thing in philosophy of perception. And so part of my point is those are completely unreliable signs. At that level, two philosophers can't tell whether they're saying the same thing about this kind of issue. Now, a little more about Putnam. Putnam thinks you can't just say, with respect to this issue here too, there's agreement between him and McDowell across the disagreement. There's a kind of methodological agreement between Putnam and McDowell. Whatever this question means, neither of them think that it's a satisfying answer to somebody who thinks, no, our cognitive powers cannot reach all the way objects themselves. Say, yes, it can. Remember what the natural man thinks. Hooray for the natural man. We should think what the natural man says. We stand with him. This is the philosophical party of the natural man. Vote for us. Forget about those people. So neither of them think that's going to work. They think, you know, once you got this problem, it's not enough to just remind people what we'd ordinarily say. So they're trying to distinguish themselves from another kind of philosopher they might look like. So they both think we need to figure out why it has seemed compelling to deny this. We need to understand why our philosophical consciences are troubled. So it no longer looks like you can just say, yes, our cognitive powers do reach. And so that's the point in Putnam of saying we must excavate the interface conception. See that this has become a tempting assumption. And get rid of it, because that will allow us then to make this return to the natural realism of the common man. So he doesn't want to just be sort of an ostrich burying his head in the sand, ignoring all of the problems in philosophy. He wants to be solving them by pointing out there's this assumption, which if you can get it clear and out in the open enough, looks very unattractive. And then if you don't make it, you don't have the problems. And again, I want to say, for all of their differences, I'm going to try to point out, methodologically, Putnam and McDowell are doing something similar there. But they have a very different issue that they've got their teeth into across the Dewey Lectures in Mind and World. How am I doing for time? Good, a few minutes. So that's one thing we want to see. Another thing we want to see when we look at this is that I think the Putnam-McDowell case, if you read the Dewey Lectures and you read Mind and World, you read the Dewey Lectures again, maybe you read Mind and World again, get to the point where you understand both of those books well, and you really have the words in them, you have a very nice illustration of something I think happens all the time in philosophy, but I think this is a nice example of it, which is you will notice that many, many phrases, forms of words, whole sentences from Mind and World occur in the Dewey Lectures. There's a lot of paraphrase of McDowell in the Dewey Lectures. He's just read it. It's not plagiarism. He's very open about how much he owes McDowell. He's got footnotes in some places. I'm sure he doesn't know exactly when he's ventriloquizing, when he doesn't, but he's certainly not trying to hide the fact that he's been very influenced by John McDowell. Great man, John McDowell. Great book, Mind and World. Read it. And he's... there's many, many phrases, including this. This itself, well, here in the quotation, it makes it sort of clear. This is sort of an echo of McDowell's view. But all over the place, there are these echoes of McDowell. And the reason I've chosen this example is because what I want to say is that although he's in some sense quoting McDowell perfectly, he is completely misrepresenting his view. Because what happens to all of these McDowellian phrases he's quoting through most of the Dewey Lectures is that they're getting shoehorned into a Cartesian problematic in which what they mean is something quite different than what McDowell's trying to say in Mind and World. So this is a slightly more extreme case of something I tried to show you before. Before, I showed you a case drawn from Lewis and Price. I could have taken other examples. But Lewis and Price, where you had many sentences in common, but they were talking about something different. They were talking about objects presenting themselves to consciousness and trying to isolate the given, and the given being something that, and so forth. And showing you that actually they're talking about very different things. That the words are the same and some of the sentences are the same. But here we have a slightly more extreme case because we have one guy actually quoting and paraphrasing the other guy. He's just trying to say what he said. And of course, on one criterion of saying what he said, he's doing great. That is, if you want to check the quotations, in some cases, he hasn't moved the words around. Here, the measure of saying what he said isn't whether he put the same words. I mean, it isn't. If McDowell said, do our cognitive powers make contact with the objects themselves rather than reach the objects themselves, that wouldn't be the measure of whether he's getting McDowell right or not. You could paraphrase either way. The question is, what does reach or make contact mean? What's the philosophical issue? And I think this happens all the time in philosophy. You have people, philosophers who take themselves to be influenced by philosophers, paraphrasing them perfectly. I think Kant himself is a great example. Those people are explicating Kant, but Wittgenstein's another example. But completely changing what all of the words mean, while quoting it perfectly, by having restructured the philosophical context in which the phrases are operating. So I think it's a particularly interesting case of something I'm trying to illuminate through this one pair of examples of Cartesian and Kantian problems, is the way in which you can have systematic failure of understanding of philosophy. But you can't locate it the way we're often taught to locate understanding. You can't use even faithful paraphrasing quotation as a measure of understanding. One of the problems in philosophy, this is why encyclopedia articles are so useless, is you write an encyclopedia entry in Kant's philosophy. And there's a sense in the whole thing can be a pastiche of Kant. But the whole thing can also be a complete misunderstanding of Kant that it's setting up. But in the way in which it's incurring all of those encouraging and understand all of those sentences, which are a pastiche from Kant, that are incurring in the encyclopedia article. Okay. So that's what we're going to want to look at when we come back. See you in 10 minutes.